Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. I'd like to welcome everyone here. I just came from a memorial service for a late dear colleague, Dr. Alan Bates, and my three legislative colleagues on this task force are still down there. They'll, I'm sure, be trickling in. But I thought we should get started so that we can move along. We have three major items that we're going to be talking about today. First, short-term transitional leave. Then a new program, pilot program that's in the works in Multnomah County, the pre-entry legal services program. And then the issue of the children of incarcerated parents, and particularly we're thinking about developing a Bill of Rights for the children of incarcerated parents. So that will be a very interesting discussion. And then we have time, if we have time, a little discussion about where we are on bills. So before we start, why don't we just go around the table and then our guests to see who's here. Again, I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Northeast and Southeast Portland in the Oregon Senate, where I also chair the Committee on Workforce and chair this task force. So, Jim?
Jim Booker, Oregon Employment Department Federal Programs Manager.
Brian Judd, Program Manager for Mercy Corps' Reentry Transition Center in Portland, Oregon.
Mike Schmidt, the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
I'm Laura Johnson. I work with sponsors. I'm the Director of Program Development there, sitting in for Paul Solomon.
And Cheyenne?
Yes. I'm staff of the task force, Cheyenne Ross.
Andrea Pope, Legislative Affairs with the Oregon Employment Department.
I'm Lisa Charnage with the Marion County Board of Commissioners Office.
Marie Garcia, Legislative and Government Relations Manager for the Department of Corrections.
I'm Jessica Katz with the Water Conservation
Manager. Noah Sweet, mother of a child abused out of parent who was incarcerated.
Kendra Wright, right here with Ms. Noah Sweet.
Kylie Grunow, and I'm doing Government Relations for the YWCA.
I'm sorry, Kylie.
Government Relations for the YWCA.
Tim Colahan, Executive Director for the Oregon District Attorney's Assistant.
Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director, Department of Corrections.
Michelle. Department of Corrections and Short-Term.
I'm Amanda Hess, Government Relations for Partnership for Safety and Justice.
Kate Gonzalez, Political Director at the Oregon Justice Resource Center.
Alex Bassos, I'm the Director of Training and Outreach at the Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland.
Great. Okay, well, welcome all of you. And so the first item we have is short-term transitional leave. And so I'm happy to turn it over to the guru of short-term transitional leave, who is also a member of our task force, Mike Schmidt.
Well, thank you, Senator. Actually, I brought the guru with me. It's Jeremiah Stromberg, so it's and he brought someone with him. So, but thank you for finding some time on the agenda again. Last time, I think I had just a few minutes at the very end to kind of give a quick summary, and I was on the phone, and I appreciate being able to be here in person and kind of show the task force some of the findings from short-term transitional leave to date. So we kind of, Jeremiah and I will work on this together. He oversees the division in Department of Corrections that implements short-term transitional leave. So he has a lot of the facts and figures, and luckily they've prepared a presentation for us. And I can kind of get into for the committee in terms of where the Public Safety Task Force is, which is the oversight body for justice reinvestment legislation that came out in 2013. They're in the process of writing a report, so I can tell you where they are on terms of short-term trans leave and then answer any questions that the committee has from there. So I think it best to start off with Jeremiah kind of walking us through what's actually going on in the program and answer questions.
So as Mike said, we did prepare a PowerPoint. I know it's going to be a little difficult to see for some of you. But certainly stop me if you have questions about any of the data. So maybe if I'll just sit on this side of the table so I can see the and hopefully can change it from here. So short-term transitional leave is a program that the Department of Corrections has had since actually about the mid-80s. It wasn't until the passage of House Bill 3194 in the 13-15 session that it expanded to a 90-day program that the department was much more proactively seeking out inmates who would qualify to participate in the program and then working hand-in-hand with the counties to really develop a smooth transition back to the community for those inmates that certainly qualified to be a part of the program. Currently, the criteria is as follows. You cannot be serving a mandatory minimum sentence within the Department of Corrections. So that right away disqualifies 50% of our inmate population, maybe even slightly higher than that. You cannot have previously failed while out on trans leave. So if you're back on a new custody cycle with the department, and that is in part due to having failed during your time in the community while still an inmate on trans leave, then you're not going to be able to participate again. You need to be minimum custody status with no major violations or failure of a program within the last 12 months. We recognized a lot of our inmates have a very rough start coming into the Department of Corrections, and we don't want to hold all violation behavior against someone, because certainly as someone moves through their time with us, gets involved with treatment programming, clean time, that we see a lot of change in behavior. And so we want to incentivize that positive change and certainly not hold old violations against individuals. Community corrections, the counties have to also accept the release plan, and that typically means there must be viable housing for this population. Since we have the discretion to keep someone in custody for an additional 90 days, if they don't have permanent housing, then we won't release onto trans leave, and we'll spend that additional 90 days looking at housing options so that when we must release them, hopefully there's something other than homelessness or a shelter or a really bad living situation. And then finally, the decision and the totality of all that information does lie with the Department of Corrections to use its discretion in determining who should go out and who should. Hard chart to see. Basically, we track by month everyone who releases, whether on 30-day trans leave or 90-day trans leave. We continue to average about 100 inmates a month that are releasing onto trans leave. That is about 50% of the eligible population that's releasing every month. So you consider the screening criteria I showed you in the previous slide, and we end up with about 100 a month that are going out on the program. Of those going out, it's about a pretty even third split between those that were incarcerated for person offenses versus property offenses versus statutory offenses. So, again, the program is open to all inmates who are not serving a mandatory minimum, so we certainly see all other crime types represented in those that are being released out onto trans leave. Along with that, we track by gender who's getting access to the program. What this chart shows you is that 17% of the trans leave participants are women, and yet women make up 9% of the DOC population. So they're represented almost twice as much on trans leave. To be expected, there are more qualifying crimes within our female population than our male population. And quite honestly, the women in our care and custody behave much better and complete programs at a higher rate than the men do. And so we have a larger pool to be able to provide the program to. And then obviously some of the most important stats we track is how well are individuals doing when they're out in the community. In a review of the first And I probably should have said, since the passage of 3194, we've released more than 3,200 inmates onto trans leave. And again, that's a mix of both 30-day trans leave and 90-day. So a review of, I think this was approximately about the first 2,900 that went out. 90% were successful. Well, let's not use the word successful. 90% while in the community did not receive a jail sanction. So when you're on trans leave, you are supervised by a parole officer who treats you like anyone else on supervision in an attempt to use local sanctions and services and programs to hold the inmates accountable, to assist them with programming, with housing, with treatment, whatever it may be. And they can use short stays in jail for violations of the conditions of trans leave. And what we found is 10% of those while on trans leave do violate and end up having a jail sanction. We were very pleasantly surprised by this number. This is a high level of success as far as not receiving a jail sanction. We really talk about how the first 120 days back in the community are the most difficult. It's a time of rebuilding relationships, forming new relationships, becoming stable, getting access to all of the needs and services. And we see a lot of failures during this time. But with this population, we've seen a lot of success. And that then plays out as well when I do want to talk about success, as we have seen 95% of those on trans leave successfully complete the program and stay in the community for the entire trans leave period and continue on then to their post-prison supervision. Only 5% have been returned to the Department of Corrections during the trans leave period. And of those 5%, 3% of them were for technical violations. So for repeat violation behavior, but was not a new crime. And only 2%, 54 individuals, committed a new crime while they were out on trans leave. Those crimes, for the most part, consist of drug crimes. They make up at least 80% of the crimes that we've seen, so continued struggles with addiction. And the most serious offenses we've seen is we have had a couple of our trans leavers at least be charged with assault four, both domestic violence and non-domestic violence assault four cases. And then there's a few other property offenses we've seen in there too, as far as some theft and ID theft charges as well. But for the most part, again, when we look at the fact that this is a population who otherwise would have been incarcerated, we feel very comfortable and confident. And obviously, while we never want to see a new victim, this at least tells us that we are at least releasing the right population and then responding to them appropriately should they continue to violate while on trans leave. And please cut me off if there's any questions while I'm going through this.
But I do have a question.
Yes.
So the those who have reoffended, you're looking at during that 90-day period that they're on short-term leave?
For this particular statistic and graph, yes. A little later in the presentation, we're going to talk about some of the longer-term outcomes that we've seen since the program started. So for those that were returned for a new crime, what we found is that while the behavior rose to the level of finding them in violation of a new crime, slightly more than half of them were not actually convicted or have yet to be convicted for a new crime in the community. And for those that were, we've seen 18 new felony convictions and 7 new misdemeanor convictions. And again, this is out of 3,000 individuals in the community during a 90-day period of time. So we do continue to track what are the outcomes to their cases, how many received new DOC sentences, again, which were 18 individuals for this reporting period, which consisted of from March of 2014 through July of 2016. Oh, and then as far as the disposition of those cases, individuals have been placed both on probation
served straight jail sentences in their local county, and 8 individuals who not only were returned on trans leave, but then received a new DOC sentence that started then upon the completion of that that current sentence. So, again, out of 3,008 that received a new Department of Corrections sentence. One of the concerns from the counties when we first decided to expand trans leave, and it was passed in 3194, is this going to be putting the cost and responsibility of housing dangerous, high-risk individuals in county jails? And is DOC merely moving their population out of their own beds and putting them into county beds? What you can tell from this chart, and what I can't tell from this distance, so let me pull it up here, is that between March of 2014 and July of 2016, the trans leave population utilized 4,600 jail beds in the community. That's for those local jail sanctions I talked about a few slides ago. During that same course of time, with the number of inmates that were in the community, we saved 168,000 DOC prison bed days. So when you look at the comparison, it's very evident and clear that this was not a shifting of resources to county jails. This did not put an additional burden on county jails. If you average out those 4,600 days across all our county jails in the state, it results in one additional bed being filled per jail in the state. And so the impact on our local jails was minimal. And what we have really strived to do is that if somebody truly needs a longer period of incarceration and removal from the community, is to return them back to a DOC bed and not continue to put that burden on the counties. And at the same time, thanks to the Justice Reinvestment Initiative of funding through the Criminal Justice Commission, the counties were able to utilize, if needed, a portion of those monies to offset the cost for their jail beds as well. And so we've just been pleased with the results to see that it hasn't just been a shifting of cost back to the community. And then, Senator Dembrough, to get to your question, we did, DOC, in concert with the CJC, did a study on at least the first group, the first 1,000 that went out onto trans leave, and how did they do during their first year in the community once they were off supervision. Again, since we only started this program really taking effect in January of 2014, we still need some time to do some longer-term recidivism studies, but we wanted to see what does it look like for the person who was incentivized, did well in prison, completed their programming, had good behavior, compared to the person who didn't get trans leave. Are we increasing the risk to public safety? Are we decreasing it? Or is it the same? Can we shave 90 days off a sentence and still get the same impact in public safety results? So what we did is we wanted to look at exact twins. We wanted to look at, and you'll have to use your imagination for this. Let's pretend Mike Schmidt and I are twins. Obviously, he's a younger, taller, more handsome twin. But let's pretend, for the sake of argument, he and I are the same age, we're in prison for the same crime, we have the same risk score, and we both are eligible for trans leave when we enter prison. And Mike earns it, good behavior, completes his treatment program, and I don't earn it. I have violating behavior, or I decide I'm not going to do the treatment program, and so I'm not eligible to go out on trans leave. So those are the types of individuals we looked at. Exact matches, one went out, one didn't. And what we found, and it's a little hard, I know, for those of you in the back of the room to see this, is that for those that went out onto trans leave in the first year, they were rearrested at a 2% lesser rate than those that didn't go out on trans leave. And they were reconvicted at a 4% less rate than those who didn't go out on trans leave, and they were reincarcerated with the Department of Corrections at about a 3.5% less rate than those who didn't receive it. So you could look at this and you could say, wow, well, we're not really seeing any great results. But again, we would have celebrated if it had merely broken even. We could have said, we saved you 168,000 DOC prison bed days, and we got you the same result. Instead, we get to tell you, we saved you 168,000 prison bed days, And we slightly improved public safety as well by seeing a slight reduction in this population. I would tout this as a success, that this program is not increasing the risk to the community, that we are seeing slightly better outcomes in the first year, and what the commitment for the Department of Corrections and the Criminal Justice Commission is, we want to continue to follow this cohort and then also look at a larger cohort, as we've had now an additional 2,000 inmates go out on the program, to really be able to see, do these trends hold true? Do they increase? Do they decrease? And are we still getting what certainly the state is expecting from this program? Which I would argue is, first, that we're transitioning people appropriately and providing them the resources they need to be successful. And second, and we're able to save a little bit of money at the same time doing it. So that concludes at least our current study of where we're at with the trans-leave population.
So like Jeremiah said, we're going to we'll work together to update that study and have it published in January. So we'll have then 2 years of recidivism data that we can follow this group with, but also we can do a larger cohort for the one-year look. So just to make sure that we're continuing to see the same trends that we saw in this group. But what's significant about this is these are statistically significant results. So the researchers in my shop do the analysis, and they've determined that this is not just by chance that we got lucky. They can do a regression analysis and things that I don't understand. But they can do that and determine whether or not the results are statistically significant, and these results are. So we believe that we will continue to see the same trend even when we take a longer look. So like Jeremiah said, really positive for the program that it has, in terms of justice reinvestment and statutory changes, it's been the most significant DOC bed saver in the entire bill. And at the same time, the community is actually safer. There are less people recidivating than their twins who are getting out 90 days later. So a huge success for the program and for the work that DOC is doing. And like Jeremiah said, getting the right people into the program. So the next thing that this kind of begs is then, well, as we are in this situation where we're considering DOC is looking at the OSPM, the Oregon State Prison Minimum Facility for Women, to expand into that because of Coffee Creek being overpopulation. A lot of people, including the Public Safety Task Force, have asked us, you know, what would it look like if we expanded this program? And so we've done some analysis into the different day amounts of expansion, and it would certainly alleviate some of that over a longer period of time, the growth that we're experiencing. And the options that we've looked at have been if it was to be expanded to 120 days, 150 days, or to double it at 180 days. So we've done that analysis, and I can supply you, Mr. Chair, and the Commission with what that looks like over time in terms of bed relief. But with that comes a lot of conversation about some, you know, potentially unintended consequences. Obviously, from a Department of Corrections perspective, they would have, if you doubled the length of time, they'd have double the amount of offenders being supervised in the community that are still under Department of Corrections control. It has some other consequences in terms of we already have an alternative incarceration program, which this committee heard testimony on about earlier on, and whether or not we would be undercutting the incentives for people to participate in AIP if we expanded short-term trans leave. So it's not just a simple cut and dry, I think, should we expand it and save and continue to see these results. And so where the Public Safety Task Force is right now, we're in the process of writing our legislative report to the governor and to the legislature on how the Justice Reinvestment Program has gone. And to this point, they'll finalize it at the end of this month, and we'll send it out in October. But they've decided that they would like to continue to see how this program works, and specifically looking at these recidivism rates and seeing if there would be any improvement or if it doesn't, if we don't hold these same improvements over time. So right now, we don't anticipate that task force is going to recommend expansion of the program. And so that's kind of where the conversation is for the moment. We've run the numbers. It clearly would be a huge bed saver. There are some very legitimate concerns about what that would do. And so the task force right now, I don't think, is going to take the position that it should be expanded immediately, that they want to study it and have more time to look at it.
So just to follow up on that, Mike, how much time do you think they feel they need to be able to make a definitive conclusion that it's perhaps expandable?
You know, I think some members of the task force are there and some want to see more data. I'm hopeful that after we have the two-year report, so that'll be in January, that'll give them two good years of recidivism data that they can look at and make sure that, you know, these trends continue. But there really hasn't been a discussion or a commitment of once we see that, then we'll make our decision. So it's a, you know, it's a complicated conversation for a lot of different partners at the table. And one of the things that's important about justice reinvestment and the reason that short-term trans leave, I think, has worked as well as it has is because all of public safety was a partner at the table in making this work. That's really kind of crucial to the success, to have, you know, from the courts and the district attorneys being bought in at sentencing and the community corrections directors being bought in when they are accepting people back into their communities. So, you know, I think it's important for everyone to be comfortable and be able to weigh in. But at this time, they're, as a task force, not committed to making that recommendation.
On that last point, Tim, I wonder if you would come up and say something on behalf of the DAs. You can be Jen for the moment.
I will be brief, I promise. Once again, I'm Tim Colahan. I was district attorney in Harney County for 29 years, and I just became the new executive director for the District Attorneys Association beginning of this month. The expansion of short-term transitional leave from 30 to 90 days, as been pointed out, was part of 3194, and that came as a result of a pretty torturous 5 months of negotiations that really included a very comprehensive review of sentencing policies and sentencing laws. It came also as a result of an understanding that the changes that short-term transitional leave put into place would be analyzed for 3 to 4 years. And it sounds like there has been, that analysis is happening. Michael Schopp is doing a great job on that. But DAs believe and strongly that the type of analysis that is being contemplated really needs to continue. So well-reasoned review of the effect that this change will have both on recidivism and crime rates can be analyzed. So that's the position of the DA's Association.
And let me ask you, Tim, what are the primary concerns that the DAs have? I mean, are they the burden on other services or other programs that Mike alluded to, or is it more sort of, you know, philosophical that inmates should do their time to the maximum?
That's a good question. I think it's multifaceted. Part of it has to do with truth in sentencing, that when somebody receives a sentence in open court, that people can walk away from that court and know that that sentence means something. I think part of it has to do with, once again, the understanding that when negotiations occurred with 3194, there was an agreement that things would not change for a certain period of time. But I think to go back to Mike Schmidt's comment that if this program is expanded, then when you increase that number of people out in the field, it's going to put additional stresses on community corrections programs. And I think they've done a great job of screening the folks both at DOC and the reach-in programs that occur through the community corrections programs. But when you increase the number of people that are going to be eligible, it's going to put increased stresses.
So that might be an argument not to double the number. but how about an incremental increase?
We will certainly want to be involved in that conversation, of course.
Sorry.
Chair, if I may, certainly in regards to this body's work as a reentry body, one thing that we'll certainly have to take a look at is we're starting to see an increase from community corrections agencies saying we don't have available transitional housing. So in the first 3 months of 2016, 23 inmates were denied release to the county merely for the reason we did not want to release them as homeless. In the second 3 months of 2016, it was 46 denials. So it is double just in the first half of this year. So one of the areas that we would certainly have to look at is the county's capacity to serve this population, that we could double or triple the length of time and yet still not release very many more than we currently are if the county doesn't have the resources available. And so that is a mix of conversation from how community corrections grant aid dollars are utilized to how justice reinvestment dollars are utilized to other housing services and just capacity within some of our counties, but certainly something I would want a reentry body to give some thought to as well.
That's a very good point. Because just to, although, you know, you presented this more in the quantitative perspective, looking at this program qualitatively, what makes it work is having secure housing, it's having wraparound services. Those are the essential components to it, right? As well as having a willing and sort of more reliable population who's entering it.
Right.
Well said. All right, Lou, do you have any questions? Any other?
One thing.
Yes, I'm sorry, Brian.
Brian Judd with Mercy Corps. The 120 number had been floated before as something that would be helpful, and from the reentry side of it, one of the things that comes out of it is a lot of times they're mandated to participate in programming, whether it's substance abuse or cognitive, which is really important. With the 90 days, what I've seen in it in the last 5 years, with short-term trans leave, if they're not set up with that right away, it might take a week or 2 weeks to get in. What's happening is that short-term trans leave period is expiring right before they're in the last maybe 15 to 30 days of treatment. Most of them are 90-day programs. And I see a lot of people at the end of that, they're off trans leave, they don't have to answer, they get a new PO because they're off short-term trans leave. So just on the side of not extending it or doubling it, but I think from a provider standpoint, as well as reentry, having that little extra time to get them engaged in a program and having time to complete it before their short-term trans leave is up would be something I think would weigh in to have some impact, the ability of people to complete that, I think would probably help some results. So just a thought.
So is 90 days a typical length of a period?
I think they're minimum usually 13 weeks. It's about 90 days. And, you know, depending on how soon they can get in, if it's substance abuse, they have to do a mental health assessment as well. Getting those scheduled, you know, it's not unheard of to have 2, maybe even 3 weeks, depending on, you know, caseloads at treatment providers, to get them enrolled. And then they're in, you know, maybe phase three of a three-month program or the third month when their trans leave ends, and that's when kind of the teeth come out from under them and they're getting a new PO, and there's just a few people get lost in the shuffle there that aren't being mandated to complete treatment because the amount of time it takes to get them enrolled once they're released. I mean, the POs are doing a great job, I think, especially in Multnomah County, and I was in Clackamas County for a few years, of having the release plans and having people to help explain what they're expected to do when they get out. Even with the DOC counselors we've worked with, they're doing a good job of telling them what's expected. But still, if there's a time delay of them getting engaged, then we have them off trans leave with a few weeks left to complete. And I just think that window of having the, we'd see better completion rates, which I think would help recidivism in the long run. But.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. Actually, I had a question, and then I was shocked out of it by the arrival of my good colleague. Senator Wick.
I have that effect.
Chair, maybe while you're thinking about that, just to respond, it's true. The end of trans leave onto post-prison supervision is a transition time, and I know for many counties it means a new PO. What we have done, though, to keep the conditions consistent, so that if you have a treatment condition on trans leave, you will also have it on post-prison, is we work with the parole board in the setting of all of our conditions so that they are consistent and the same, so that from day 90 to day 91, there is no change in what is going to be expected of you. You're just under a different authority. But again, there are some barriers as it relates to different POs with specialized caseloads, and the one thing, the most significant change for the inmate is there's no longer the fear or hammer of being returned to prison hanging over your head. From there on out, you would do local sanctions, and return to prison is no longer something they have to consider. So certainly some validity to the statement, and yet we have done a lot of work to create a seamless transition between the two programs, so that whether you're under the board's authority or DOC's, the expectations and conditions will be the same.
I remember my question now, so thank you. It goes back to the housing situation. So one of the benefits of the program is that the person released has secure housing. And then what happens after the 90 days? Are they guaranteed of holding on to that housing, or, you know, how secure does the housing remain?
Yeah, and great question and a difficult one to answer. For each county, that's going to look a little differently. There's nothing magical about the 90 days that changes what level of subsidy you'll receive from the county for housing. It comes down to just the amount of subsidy available within that county. So some counties provide only up to 30 days of housing with an expectation that during that 30 days, we got to come up with something else. We have actually had, and Tracy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we've had a couple of individuals return to our custody in DOC because they've lost that housing even during the trans leave period. And again, our commitment is that we won't have homeless inmates in the community for whom they don't have a roof over their head and access to three meals a day. And if that means we need to bring them back into the department, we will. For other counties, their transition housing may last from 3 to 6 months because of the level of resource, or where it's partial pay between the client and the county so that they can extend that stay. And so we see it play itself out in a variety of forms, really depending on the level of resource within the county. But merely completing transitional leave would not result in removal from a housing placement. It would have more to do with whatever that current resource and policy is within the county for how long you can stay there.
In order to have a better understanding of the scope of housing availability during transition leave, can you provide this committee or either Mike with what exists or what the length of housing is that each county is able to provide? Because I know that, you know, I've always been very envious of the commitment that has been made in Clackamas County, for example. And Clackamas County has done, of the counties, a tremendous job in helping to provide housing resources for individuals. So I think it would be helpful to know.
Yes, I think we can get close and at least paint a picture of what's available. For many of our smaller communities, for example, it may be a week or a month contract with a local motel. So their answer would be, we have zero housing, but sometimes we have a little extra money to do some temporary housing and those. So we'll have some caveats in there, Senator, but
That's
we can
good.
Certainly paint a picture of what
That's
the
good.
State of housing looks like for this population.
Yeah, that would be very useful.
Senator, if I could just interrupt.
Please.
I know that you and I served together on the Justice Reinvestment Task Force grant review, and I know you will recall the number of counties that were using that money for transitional leave. Harney County did. We bought a duplex put the women on one side, the men on the other. And I know many counties relied on that justice reinvestment money for that purpose.
I raise that because I've, as those of you who know of studying, I mean, and on the now, justice reinvestment and some of the work we were doing on 3194, including looking at what resources existed with respect to drug courts and some of the other tools that we use, that what we don't have available to us, and Mike, you can weigh in, we do not have a good, for the overall for the state of Oregon, a data mapping that tells us what exists and where the gaps are. I've said continually, that we really need that information in order to do a better job of planning, in order to deploy resources, and where some of those gaps, whether we're talking drug courts or in this case, we're talking housing availability.
I think it really strikes to the very purpose of this task force, actually, since housing is such an essential part of successful reentry.
Yeah.
That we really need to know what's out there. So that would be great.
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah, Senator, if I may, one of the great other positive things of the 3194 legislation was also the studying of what is going to work and what's happening in the communities. And so we actually are undertaking a controlled trial of looking at just housing to see how effective having housing is in recidivism reduction. So, and our study is simply looking at just housing. Many counties are able to provide more. Sponsors, for example, is a great place that has housing and programs and everything's wrapped in around that. They're also in the process, I know from talking to Paul Solomon, of doing a trial of looking at their specific program with housing and other services. So I think in the next several years, we'll have a couple of Oregon-specific studies coming out to really quantify exactly how much of an impact housing in and of itself has, where if you're in a Harney County situation where your resources are more limited, but you can at least provide a roof, we can look at what kind of an impact does that have on recidivism. And then, of course, Sponsors is going to be working on their study with more of a robust wraparound service housing model. And so we're hoping very close we'll be able to do that, find out what the recidivism results are. And once we have that information, that's what we need to be able to wrap into a cost-benefit analysis that we could provide to the legislature, the governor, and say, this is the expected effect size of recidivism reduction when you just do housing, when you do housing with wraparound services. And so you can really kind of see the dollar, for every dollar you invest, the outcome that you get back. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a positive thing out of the justice reinvestment legislation, and excited to see what Sponsors has going too.
But I would have assumed there are existing studies that look at that, right? So what will be unique to Oregon about these studies, Mike?
There really aren't that many studies. I would have assumed that as well, Senator. In fact, I did. And there really aren't. So the study that we're doing specifically, because a lot of, especially our counties who are receiving, maybe $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 grant from Justice Reinvestment, investing that all into housing might be the only and most significant thing that they can do. And so that in and of itself, I'm not aware of any study that looks at just housing as the isolated variable in trying to determine what impact that has on recidivism. So as far as I know, that research hasn't been done. Across, there might be some other studies more in line with what Sponsors is studying, but even that, from talking to Paul, I know is very sparse.
Not with respect to randomized control trials or real accurate information, no. There have been some quasi-experimental studies, but they have been pretty small as well.
Yes.
May I add another data point that I'd be curious about per county? What the homeless rate is in those counties. Just to see what we're comparing.
Overall homeless rate, or specific to those under
correctional
control?
Right now, overall homeless rate. know that it'll be more difficult to get to the specifics, but overall.
Well, the other would be interesting, too.
Yes, it would be.
If
you can get it, that'd be great, but I doubt it.
Sorry.
Is there a way of teasing out, I mean, overall is great, but is there a way of teasing out, like, veterans and felons? I think that they have that ability.
Well, if you do, that'd be great. I was trying to get at least one data point that we could compare it to, because you were talking about the fact that you needed to compare to see whether there was whether you didn't want to send people out and make them homeless. So let's see what we already have.
Yeah. We'll look into that. Yeah.
Thank you.
And just because Senator Winters, or was it Lou? I don't know which of you mentioned the word veterans. I want to remind you that we have just received a report from the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force, and that's up on the website. And for those of you who may be watching this hearing now or at some future point, that report is among the meeting materials for today's meeting, as is the presentation that Jeremiah gave us. Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen. We have to move on to the next issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. So let's move on. Alex, you want to come up and tell us about, we're tired of talking about reentry, so we're going to talk about pre-entry. And you're going to tell us we should have started with pre-entry.
I don't know about that. As far as I can tell, I made up the word. The idea, the basic premise is that there are some things that we can do prior to a person entering incarceration to stabilize the person and increase their chances of success on their way out of prison. Primarily what we're talking about are stabilizing financial things that are going on, putting child support in abeyance, negotiating a termination of the person's lease, ending benefits that would otherwise continue, consumer debt that would otherwise continue. If you don't stop these things, then that debt just keeps on increasing while the person is incarcerated, including child support, which can't retroactively be reduced and can itself lead to potential felony charges, not to mention the collections and the credit and the increased difficulty getting employment and housing. So those are things that are not that difficult to do on the front end prior to incarceration, but are incredibly difficult to deal with on the back end. If I could just give a little context for this program, we are in the process in our office of trying to shift from a traditional model of public defense that focuses on the case and solely success on the criminal case to a larger success with the client, a more client-focused or holistic defense, meaning that at the very beginning of the case, we are assessing for all of the person's social service needs, including education and employment and housing and mental health and medical needs and crisis services and whatever exists, as well as legal and civil legal needs like immigration and evictions, and again, whatever other legal needs a person has, and then meeting those needs as best we can within our office and otherwise seamlessly connecting the person to agencies in the community that we have relationships with. In the process of mapping all the resources that exist in Washington and Multnomah counties, we ended up meeting with folks at the Reentry Transition Center who told us in no uncertain terms that we really ought to be doing this kind of thing. We all really ought to be thinking about reentry prior to the time they go into incarceration, because we were making their lives more difficult, which sort of made this light bulb go on over our heads for those of us that were in that meeting and really thinking about what it means to shift over to a truly client-focused approach. How can we figure out how to get this person onto a path to long-term success rather than just just success on the criminal case, which means that our job doesn't end at sentencing. We need to be making sure that this person is set up with the services. We need to be thinking about this client as ours as they transition into the community, regardless of whether they've been incarcerated, because there's a lot that we can do in that regard. But this idea in particular of thinking more broadly about our client's success prior to going into prison is the real big aspect of this program, I guess. What we're doing in and of itself is a huge cultural shift and is certainly time-consuming to some extent. But there's nothing particularly magical about making sure that a person's financial obligations are settled before they are taken out of the community for a year or seven. It just ends up being incredibly important to the client to settle their affairs, as we would all want someone to do with us if we were being taken out of the community for a few years.
So, Alex, so what is the status of the program, first of all?
I mean, it is part of this larger transition. It is an idea of mine that I worked on with some clients. We developed this nice package where we have a protocol and an interview and questions, and we've tested it out on a few dozen clients, and it seems to work really well. On every single client that we talked to, there were things that could be done. There was increased stability that we were able to provide. I guess it would be nice to have a small amount of funding to go with it, to call it a pilot project of any real nature. But, I mean, we're going to keep on keeping on, regardless of whether there's funding.
Well, Alex, Nancy just met with me today on this particular issue. She didn't have an ask for me yet. But I figured that was coming we come to the process. My question is, how many clients have you gone worked through it to date? Number one, and how many of the agencies in Multnomah County that you really have? It's one thing doing the checklist. It's two things to get. It's similar to what you would do on the back end of clean slate. Only you're doing it on the front end. So what's been the results?
So I guess I'm not absolutely sure I understand the question, Senator Winters. This project is just for those people who are entering prison.
Right.
So we don't know what the results are in terms of people coming out. It's so new. We just started it in the last few months this summer.
But you do know whether or not you've been able to, let's say that there is a debt that's owing in child support, the state child support. And so what has been your success or no success in dealing with whether it's the AG, DOJ AG or DAs in getting them to actually to suspend any activity until such time? But let me know more than just this is on this paper that says these are nice little checkoffs.
So we're doing a lot of work with reentry on the back end. Where we are asking judges to reduce a felony to a misdemeanor or waive fines and fees or grant relief from sex offender registration, where there's a lot of work that needs to be done, a story that needs to be told, people that need to agree with it or object, hearings that need to be had. This is actually not like that. There's a statute and an administrative rule that sets out when child support can be put in abeyance, and it's really just a matter of filling out the form and sending it in. It's remarkable that no one's doing it for the most part. Nationwide, I mean, it's really easy to do.
But
it's about 10 minutes of work.
That's quite frankly the question.
That's the question.
Why are they not? If it is so easy and it's available, do people not know about it? What is getting in the way here? Because I know of folks who probably could have used it, but they had no idea. It may be something that a lawyer would know about, but someone who's involved in something like this is not going to understand it. And their lawyer might, but they may not pass it along. What is getting in the way?
Oh, yeah, I passionately believe in the need for this program, absolutely. I'd say there are two big reasons why it hasn't happened prior to us just starting to do it for the number of clients that we have done it for, and that's really just those in our office. The first and most important is this big cultural change. That if you're thinking of your job as solely success on the criminal case, that means that you will fight to the death over $1,000 of fees that a judge might impose, but you just aren't thinking of those additional aspects of the client's life that can be stabilized. It just isn't part of how traditional criminal defense attorneys or public defense attorneys think about it. And so even those national founders of holistic defense. I was talking to Robin Steinberg from the Bronx Defenders, and she told me that, gosh, that's an amazing idea. We just have never thought of doing that as well. So it just doesn't occur to people. But then, in addition, the child support piece can take 10 or 15 minutes. You have to have the form and fill it out and make sure it's done right and get it to the right place. But when you add it all up, these things are a couple hours, and a couple additional hours on every case is not nothing. And we need to test these things out. Some of them are easy. Some of them are a little harder.
Because these are not just checklists, like the client being reminded, you need to do this.
No, that's right.
You're actually helping them.
That's right. This is all actual legal work. This is not a checklist for the client to do. This is a checklist for the attorney to do, or an attorney working with the criminal defense attorney, which is the way that we're setting it up in our office.
Or in some cases, a caseworker, right? It doesn't necessarily need to be an attorney.
Well, some of this stuff can be done by a caseworker, but a lot of it is legal. When you're talking about negotiating a reduction of debt, when you're talking about filing legal paperwork, when you're talking about negotiating a termination of the lease, these are all really important and not super difficult, but it's pretty handy having an attorney doing it.
So let me see if I can kind of boil this down to kind of the way I have to think about things. So it's the culture inside of what you currently do does not include this. I mean, you're usually looking at the trial aspects and what have you, and defending the individual. So this is additional steps, if you will, in order to the individual. So what you really would be asking for, you don't need statute to do this, right?
Correct.
You don't really need a legislation. You may, and you're saying that this is not necessarily something that a social worker or an administrative assistant or something could do, that you probably will need the legal. So the long and short of it, that when Nancy comes to visit me during budget, that you're talking about, you know, maybe this as an enhanced package?
Don't put words in the counselor's mouth.
I've already met with Nancy today, so.
Yes.
I guess I'll leave that to Ms. Cozine. I don't think it would take very much to serve the entire state, frankly. But if I were going to have an ask, I would ask that the legislature start thinking about public defense outcomes. That right now the funding model for public defense is a flat fee per case, which incentivizes solely the turning over of cases as quickly as possible and as many as possible for attorneys. So it takes people who are passionate about public defense independently to move these things forward, which is what we've been doing in our office. But we are not only not encouraged to do that, we are disincentivized to do that, and we are pushing upstream in order to think about our clients holistically and do these extra services. So if there were some encouragement to think about outcomes from the legislature, as we want to do, we want to be judged by whether our clients are succeeding in the future, whether we are reducing recidivism, whether we are doing right by our clients. But there is nothing out there that actually externally encourages the defense community to do that.
Right.
Alex, I think this is really great that you all are doing this, and I think you've set it up that you're stepping into a role that didn't previously exist. You're occupying new airspace and thinking of your job and your role differently than the way you and your office and your profession has thought of before. And I think that's really laudable to be thinking outside of the box, and I think that's really great. And I know you're super early in this, and so, you know, this is probably a let's see type of question, but are you thinking also about some of your other clients that are not prison bound? Do you see applications here to go beyond where you're starting as a pilot? Do you see benefits beyond just wrapping up affairs for prison to other types of things, like making some other connections for clients?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I meant to say that we are doing this for our whole office for all clients.
Okay.
And that the pre-entry project was later than this larger decision to culturally change. For every client, at the very beginning of the case, we want to assess for all of their social service and legal needs and start meeting those immediately, independent of whether it will help the criminal case. We want to pull in an immigration attorney, an eviction attorney, a veterans attorney, a housing attorney, whatever we need to do in addition to the parent representation attorney and the criminal defense attorney and the civil legal advocate in our office, and get those folks together all on a team. And then, you know, figure out housing and treatment and mental health services and whatever we need to do to get this person on a path to long-term success. That pre-entry project came a little later because it wasn't obvious when we're thinking about a holistic defense. Well, okay, the person's going to prison, then what do we do about that? We can't just get the person into treatment. But wait, it turns out there's a lot we can do that a person's life really can be stabilized, and it helps a lot long term if we can do these things prior to them being incarcerated. So,
okay, Mike, and just one thought.
And maybe I missed that. That's great. That's really good. What kind of outcomes and things are you hoping to see? You said you want the legislature to maybe demand more of public defenders in terms of thinking of other outcomes. How would you quantify that? What kinds of things are you looking for? And then as a follow-up, have you thought of, or is there any kind of effort to consider studying results?
We have been talking to a professor at Portland State. We're in the really early stages of trying to put together a study, figuring out controls and all that, and even being able to pull the data, even in Multnomah County, where there's better data than in other counties, so that we can compare different models, seems to be incredibly difficult. In terms of outcomes, I guess we're primarily thinking of it in terms of recidivism, but I would love to hear other suggestions of outcomes that we could be thinking about.
Well, and I'll turn over to you, Jim, in a moment, but just, one thing I think we would be interested in is sort of cost avoidance down the road, right? By taking these steps, you know, there are some ways in which that could save communities or the state money. Certainly it could help the individual and their families, but that would be very useful to know as well, or to think about. Jim?
Thank you, Senator.
I was thinking about a couple of things. One is we're looking at legislation to reduce or put these asides in the first place. If it doesn't go through, it's an alternative for us as a task force. The other is I believe that veterans are being helped with something similar to this before they get deployed through Employers for the Guard and Reserve. And they're doing things like that, saying, have you got this taken care of before you go? Have you got this taken care of? And maybe they have some results. And I can check and see if I can find anything out on that. And then I was wondering if there would be any possibility of Department of Corrections helping looking at the back end of it, since it's very, very, very new, and it might help to see if there's any way to do that. I don't know if there is. So.
Well, thanks for mentioning that. Maria, is there What kind of pre-entry, I know this is a big subject, but what kind of pre-entry does DOC do when someone is coming in?
I do know that they do receive an orientation during intake. They are providing the form to submit to child support so they could stop child support, or so they could at least modify it. And maybe that means to a zero, you know, to zero, that's up to DOJ child support. But I do know they are doing that during the intake process at orientation. And also their start through the task force on veterans services, they're also looking at having a veteran service officer meet with them as well to verify that they are veterans and so that they are receiving the benefits that they're supposed to be receiving, or if they're supposed to be stopped at that time, they're stopped like they're supposed to be. So there are some services that are being provided now. Mm-hmm. And as far as like credit, they also help prepare them prior to release as well. So as far as their credit goes and other, you know, I don't know all the ins and outs, but I did provide information to, I think, Cheyenne here recently via email.
So the question is, a couple, I mean, is it better to do these kinds of things before intake or as part of intake? What are the, you know, what are the advantages? And then what are the costs, I guess? I mean, would DOC have the capacity to take this on? And then the more qualitative question, would it be better for DOC to do it or better for it to be done while the person is still with family and community? Brian, yes.
Thank you,
answer
Senator.
This question, please.
Thanks, Senator. So last month when we met, we did have the DHS come here, and they talked about some changes that they've made where just having knowledge of someone being incarcerated, they're now able to modify on their behalf, which is new. It used to be, it might be somewhat easy now being included in the packet to modify an order, but before it was the exact form, notarized, turned in. It was a little more than most, you know, people in the system are capable of fulfilling. And there's still the point at which, when they're close enough to release, that it cannot be modified during what they're entitled to during their stay. So this definitely would be something on the front end, an investment. And like the 13-15 study of, for every dollar spent on reentry, 14 is saved. That's not taken into effect a lot of these tangibles, intangibles out there that some of these efforts would help to mitigate. You know, when you look at people's inability to get housing, all the barriers that this is looking at trying to mitigate, those numbers would be even higher on the return. And as hard as it is to get reentry data already, pre-entry data will, you know, be a little ways down the road. But without question, the ability just on the child support order, when people return to the community, they don't have to set up their payments for 60 days on their current child support. But if they have arrears, it gets attached from their first paycheck, their first paycheck. So when we have someone trying to save money for housing or pay their supervision fees, it's an immediate barrier of the amount of garnishment they're subject to. So this alone being addressed, we're lucky in Oregon to have a centralized intake at Coffee Creek where this can be disseminated. What I would like to see, and I talked to Sean Liu from Harvard the other day, he called me up with some questions. There's just a number of things that would hopefully come from this would be a model where this is what we do at the state level. This is part of our long-term strategic plan. This is what we're working on reducing barriers. And also be something that the 36 different counties that have people in their custody for a year or more could get this packet and have access to, you know, and see what that would cost to have it at the county level, because this also affects people, even some people in long-term treatment programs. This is a checklist of things that they could take care of that would make their success a lot more achievable on the tail end of it. So I'm hoping that this becomes something that people get, you know, at the county level pre-sentence, or at least access to at intake, but also something that eventually evolves into something we can share to all the different counties and even around the country. Hey, these are things you can do to help people at pre-entry. It's pretty simple. A lot of people, honestly, don't have a reliable power of attorney available to them to take care of, you know, putting a lock on their credit so it doesn't do any more damage, especially notifying landlords and avoiding an eviction and getting their stuff moved out. There's, you know, those, and that's what I meant by the intangibles I spoke to earlier. There's just no way to really put a number on it yet, but I think it would be very hopeful and promising that in the end this would be demonstrated with some good testing. And I would hate to see testing done on this. I would hate to see a control group not get this service to prove that it works. But I think that we'd be able to see in the long term, hopefully design some sort of study that might, you know, not have to have that component in it. You know, it might not be entirely empirical and statistically correct, but I think you'd be able to see that people are coming out with less barriers and maybe, you know, at the local level, you know, starting a pilot in Multnomah County or Washington County will make it fruitful enough where people, I mean, they're not going to see the results of this for quite some time, at least a year. That's what we're talking about, probably 18 months, probably longer, people that are incarcerated. So it would be hard to ask for data on it, but I can tell you if I'm working in reentry for 5 years that this would mitigate a lot of the ones that get people out. And they're going to get that first job, and they get 30% of their check taken, and they take the rest of their check and go get loaded. I mean, it's just, it's not scientific, but it's real.
Marie, there's two questions. There's the question of how much is on this checklist that can be done on those who've been adjudicated that are going into the system, because not everybody that you see are going into the system, correct?
That's correct.
You know, so you've got those who may need this particular service, for example, that their employer is notified, but they're not going to maybe end up in DOC or at Coffee Creek or whatever. So I think, you know, you've got different sets of individuals. And my question is how much is on this checklist that is done when you do intake, you know, through DOC or whatever mechanism, so that, for example, that DOJ, you know, actually is notified, so that child support pay, or wherever you have to do the notification. The same is true on court collections. The biggest collector of fees and fines is Multnomah County. I'm just going to put it out there because that's the reality. It's Multnomah County. And so how much of discussion will be handled with the judges and what in that county that they're willing to actually, you know, forego those. And, you know, I think I said that last meeting I was here, to start having some conversation with Judge Ballmer and others. Right. You know, it's one thing to notify. It's another thing of getting them to actually to suspend.
But, going back specifically to the pre-entry, I mean, it seems like a lot of these checkoff items are things that really should be done before the person enters, right? But that intake is really going to be too late for a lot of these, especially related to a lease that they might have or, you know, things where they would be much better if they knew when their sentence was to start and then in that time in between, just before that, to close up their affairs and let them know. Because if they wait until the actual intake, that could be too late for some of this stuff. Yeah.
I think it's fantastic, and I agree that it would alleviate a lot of the very tangible barriers when we're talking about facing eviction notices and things that could be prevented if done on the front end. And in addition to that, when we're in the previous discussion about housing and the challenge of folks coming out and the barriers that they're facing, they have so many things they're trying to accomplish and to take on these things that require not only significant time in the legal system, but also psychic energy to be able to really focus on treatment and housing and finding a job and not be distracted by court dates and other things that could have been taken care of on the front end. I think we would potentially see returns there as well as reducing the burden on the courts.
Okay. Mike, you had something?
Yeah, I was just going to kind of tag on to what you were saying there, Mr. Chair, and I think Alex said it well. I think there is utility to attorneys being the people who are dealing with some of these things. As opposed to an intake person at DOC, I think, you know, negotiating with landlords and things like that, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, we're going to have to move on, but it seems as if there's a lot of interest in this.
Can I ask a question, though?
Sure.
I'm going to talk to the lawyers. I'm going to talk to you from a budgetary standpoint, because I know that your organization is looking at compensation. And so if you have to make some choices, and the choices that in order to, you know, to continue this program, that maybe a paralegal or a social worker or caseworker could very well be trained to do some of this work. I'm just looking at options.
With supervision or
I'm just asking you the question, because I know that you guys have got a compensation package study that you want to.
Again, I'll leave that to Ms. Cosine. Speaking for our organization, we would love a social worker.
Because you have, if I look at your parent that particular program, you do have others besides the attorney that's assisting with that particular program that you have.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of this can be done by non-lawyers. There's a lot of work that can be done there. I think it's really helpful to have some of this negotiation.
Yeah. I mean, you have lawyers on staff, and when there is a need for a lawyer, then you could consult one of the lawyers. Yeah. Anyway, Alex, I think there's interest in this, and we'll talk about, we'll have some follow-up conversations of how the state can help with this.
Thank you, and thank you so much for allowing me to be here and talk about our programs.
It's an exciting concept, and I don't know if I'm exactly quoting Rep. Frederick, but it really seems like a no-brainer. Okay, thanks. All right, let's move on to our final topic, which is the situation of children of incarcerated parents and the relationship between family relations and successful reentry. So we have several people to talk to us about that. So you want to all come up? Yeah?
Ms. Ryan, if you just sit right along.
Yeah, that would be great. Introduce yourselves again, because my colleagues weren't here when you did.
Sure. Kylie Gurnow with the YWCA.
My name's Nova Sweet. I'm a former FPP participant, YWCA advocate, and a mom of two children.
I'm Kendra Wright. I'm a former FPP participant also, and I have one child, and I was formerly incarcerated.
My name is Jessica Katz, and I'm the program director for the Family Preservation Project, which operates multiple programs at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility and also in the community.
Okay, so my primary role here is just to turn the floor over to these two ladies, both of which they told you are graduates of the Family Preservation Project. And they're going to speak a little bit about their experiences with reentry and also how a Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents might better impact family reintegration and what that could look like and their views on that piece of it. And then from there, Senator, you can really let us know what additional information or where we should go from there.
Great.
So I'll turn over to you.
All right, so this has been super informative, and I've been taking notes because it interests me, and I feel like all the trans leave, the pre-entry, and now this topic all intertwine perfectly. I have all sorts of ideas, and I'm kept wanting to raise my hand, but I'm going to try and stay in check here. So my experience with re-entry, I would consider myself one of the more privileged re-entry inmates, if you will. I have a supportive family. I had a place to go. I was able to participate in a treatment program. I had a PO. I met all my requirements, yada, yada, yada. I'm probably in one of those success rates on the board up there. In fact, I just got a letter a couple days ago that says I'm on the lowest level. I don't know. Anyways, I definitely had it good. Some huge keys to that is the work that I was able to do inside. Piece number one, accountability, recognition, and wanting to do something different. If people don't have that, none of this is going to work. So I think it's great that everybody has these wonderful ideas on how to help people, but unless somebody's ready to do it, it's not going to work, period. So I think that there needs to be a component of, I don't know, weeding out the BS on some level, if, for lack of better words. Sorry.
Okay. No, you're good.
You used an abbreviation.
I know, I thought about that. Okay, so what I did, well, what I did in Coffee Creek was pre-entry. Everything that the gentleman that just left talked about is exactly what I did.
You did it in Coffee Creek?
I did it at Coffee Creek with the support of FPP because my correctional counselor, Mr. Wills, he would have loved to have done that, but he has too many people to do that with. I was fortunate to be in a program that could help me go, what do I need to do? Thankfully, I didn't have the big DHS column, but many of my peers had the DHS column. But I was able to contact, I did a power of attorney. I did that with my attorney before I went in so I could turn over my guardianship to my mother. Once I was inside, I was able to contact the IRS, the Oregon Department of Treasury and the IRS to say, hey, I'm incarcerated. I'm now having to pay those debts and then ask for penalties and fines to be waived after the fact. So I wonder if I could have done that on the front end, had that been different. I don't know. I was able to get my student loans out of default while I was incarcerated with FPP. I was able to work on some things around my education, my licensure, because I happen to be a social worker. So that was pretty awesome. And not only did it help take care of getting my life in order, but it gave me so much hope and like, I got this, I can do this. So those were all things that I got to do while I was incarcerated. The big piece that is not, we don't have this, is all qualitative, is the relationship with my kids. My kids were able to stay in contact with me, not only because I had a mother and an uncle who were supportive enough, but I had this program on the inside that said, write your kids a letter. Stop guilt tripping yourself. Get over it. Write your kids a letter. Then they would, if I didn't happen to have envelopes or stamps, or even if I did, they would help me do it. I just had self-addressed, address the envelope, they would read it to make sure it wasn't anything weird, and then they'd send it out for me. And I got consistent. I had an appointment every week to do that. Those were huge pieces. And although I lived in Wilsonville for 36 months, when I came home, I was making lunches for my kids the next morning. My son, who, this was a horrible story, but he got his driver's license and he wanted to drive mom home from prison. So I got car sick that day because I hadn't been in a car in 36 months. But by golly, he wanted to come pick me up. We had this relationship where he figured out how to forgive me. And all of those things were so impactful and allowed me to re-enter and like hit the ground running. And I think that the Family Preservation Project and my mother had this framework with that I think if you read the Bill of Rights that we're looking at, that they already believed like that, so it wasn't telling them anything new. What I like about the Bill of Rights is that it helps the school systems, the community counselors, the attorneys, the nurse, the coach, whoever it may be, helps them go, how do I treat this kiddo with this really sensitive subject? Because who wants to talk about this? There's so much guilt and shame related to it. And it kind of gives everybody, it's not like a rule of thumb, well, it is a rule of thumb, but it's not like the law. You're not going to get in trouble if you break the law. But it's something to kind of, help you with kid gloves and how to help a kiddo that's going through this stay connected to their parent and also disconnect them from all the crap their parent chose to do versus the kid who is not guilty in any way, shape, or form. So I'm a huge proponent for this Bill of Rights. I'm a huge proponent of the reentry, the pre-entry, the trans-leave, all this good stuff. So I'm really blessed to be here. Thank you for letting me be here. And I go on and on, but I'm going to stop.
Thanks, Noah.
Yep.
It's great to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so my name again is Kendra Wright. Reentry for me was... It started in FPP as well. I think I would want to touch a little bit on the pre-entry. I think that would have been very beneficial prior to arriving at Coffee Creek. If it wasn't for the Family Preservation Project, I wouldn't have a relationship with my child.
or at least to the extent that I currently have one. I think that if this Children's Bill of Rights was something that was implemented into all entities that are related to people and children and of incarceration, I think that there's a lot of connections that would be allowed to be made. In my situation, my daughter and I were not permitted to see each other for almost a year and a half. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that I did have a DHS involved case, and I was appealing a termination, which put a lot of stipulations on my contact with my child for fear of, you know, not being able to take back something that's said, and, you know, all the requirements that I needed to meet with DHS. The Family Preservation Project allowed me to meet those requirements, and they also acted as an advocate, allowing me to have supervised visits without the DHS worker being there, which their resources are very limited. Their caseloads are ginormous, and they're just unable to really put in the effort that's needed, needed for the child, most importantly. And so what this program does is it allows for that barrier to be overcome. They act as an advocate. They implement these Bill of Rights, making it that the child is number one. I mean, the connection between parent and child is existing, and any barriers that need to be worked out, they help you work them out. Phone calls made to DMV, that was one of the privileges I was allowed to have prior to even being close to being released back into the community. I had no clue what my financial obligations were to getting my license back until I was in this program. I knew I had fees and fines, but then the fees and fines on top of not paying those original debts, that was a huge concern and stress that I carried. And if that could have been alleviated prior to even going to prison, that would have given me the hope to want to succeed even more. And I think that's one of the key elements that is missing in someone wanting to succeed upon being released back into society is hope, knowing that there is an incentive or knowing that their children are being looked after and that these connections are continuing to be made, that's something that people actually care about. The public defender that was here, that is everything he said. If only that was implemented in every courtroom with every public defender, because I saw mine for 5 minutes twice. And, you know, I'm lucky that public defender even knew my name. And that's just, it's a turnover. It's because of levels and lack of resources and yada, yada. So if this resource could be implemented to help on all levels and everybody collaborated with one focus of protecting our children, which are our future, and stopping the cycles of addiction and incarceration, I think that would be amazing.
Okay.
This isn't going to cost any money. This is just a framework, just right. For the record. Two things that I thought of are the housing conundrum that you guys have going on. If you can start working on reentry and reforming bonds and building broken bridges while you're incarcerated, then there's a huge chunk of people that have houses they can go to. They just got to work on regaining trust and paying off debts and their own recovery. And so there's places for people to live if they can just figure out how to form a relationship back with the people that they screwed over in the first place. One. Two, a piece that I didn't mention earlier was the connection that I was able to maintain with the schools through the FPP program. I participated in all of my child's parent-teacher conferences by conference call, and I was able to email, but I didn't email, the counselors emailed back and forth to stay in connection as far as homework, assignments, and whatnot. fast forward, I'm out of prison. I'm now in the schools, and the teachers were like, "Oh, you're Nova." There's no shame or judgment cast on the fact that they knew that I was incarcerated for those 3 years. They knew that I was the mom, but it's not a big deal.
That's great.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I think one of the things that often gets lost in the conversation around reentry is what happens to children. We have a growing female population, as I think we all know in this room, and there isn't a lot of discussion about what happens to their children, but we do know that women are the primary caregivers for their children, and so the consequences to kids when a mother goes to prison are very significant. And what that looks like is they bounce around for lots of houses, lots of placements, which means lots of school, which means losing educational ground. It's really hard to catch up. We don't often know who's got legal authority over those children when a parent becomes incarcerated. So the person that has them may, for a period of time, not have the legal authority to get medical care. They may not have the legal authority to enroll in school. These are significant things for children. And we also know that there is a very significant line between childhood trauma and incarceration later in life. We know that, and there is an ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which some of you may know is a 10-point scale that identifies 10 early childhood traumas. One of those 10 early childhood traumas is parental incarceration. When you get to a 4 on that scale, you are likely to die earlier, you are likely to contract heart disease, possibly die of stroke. This has been scientifically proven. So I think it's a nice segue from the earlier conversation about pre-entry, which is not only looking at the individuals we're incarcerating, but their children as well. And there are currently very few protections for those kids. There is no safety net. I think there's an assumption that most of the kids go into foster care. Most of the kids have an attorney. Most of the kids have a safety net that catches them, but that is not the case. It's only about 10% of the kids are in the custody of the state, and the rest of the kids are in the custody of whoever gets an emergency phone call that says, "Can you take my kids?" That means that they're at risk of not, again, having health care, being enrolled in school, bouncing from placement to placement. And the Children of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights provides a really nice framework to look at some intersections of an adult's involvement in the criminal justice system, and at those intersections, what's happening to kids. For instance, we don't have a protocol with the police that asks if there are children. So an individual is arrested. There's no protocol that says the arresting officer asks, are there children? There are backstories in this Children of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights that will tell stories of a 9-year-old being left to care for a 3-year-old for weeks on end and only being noticed because the 9-year-old knew the mother took the 3-year-old on a stroller ride every day. And so the 9-year-old strapped the child in a stroller and would walk the child every day until somebody finally noticed that there hadn't been a parent around for a long time. So I think it is imperative, because of what we know about childhood trauma and later outcomes, that we really take the opportunity. And having worked in Coffee Creek for 13 years, I see it as nothing but an opportunity to do something really different. And what we have been doing is this pre-entry work. We've been doing it for a long time, and it works. This program has been in existence for 6 years, and it has a 0% rate of recidivism. Nobody has come back to prison. The affairs are in order because, as you said, it's a no-brainer. You can't step out of the prison gates. It's too late to talk about reentry when you step out of the prison gates, when you're doing nothing but spending time behind bars, 3 years, 6 years. A lot of this work could be done, the relationship building with the kids and all of this, the pre-entry work. It's a brilliant idea, and I think that at this point we can say it works because we've been doing it at Coffee Creek for 13 years.
So, Jessica, you know, in terms of the sort of framework, the values framework that the Bill of Rights provides, I have before me the one from California. That's kind of the model that you're thinking of. And let me just read what these principles are. And I think what's being thought of here is going to be very similar to what we passed with foster youth, right? The Bill of Rights for foster youth. So, one, I have the right to be kept safe and informed at the time of my parents' arrest. Two, I have the right to be heard when decisions are made about me. Three, I have the right to be considered when decisions are made about my parent. Four, I have the right to be well cared for in my parents' absence. Five, I have the right to speak with, see, and touch my parent. Six, I have the right to support as I struggle with my parents' incarceration. Seven, I have the right not to be judged, blamed, or labeled because of my parents' incarceration. And eight, I have the right to a lifelong relationship with my parent. So this creates the sort of, you know, the framework. This is how we want the world to be, right? What it means in its specifics, you know, is, I mean, that's not dictated here. But as programs are being developed, as decisions are being made, these values are considered. That's kind of what you're after here, isn't it?
And I think ultimately, excuse me, as one of you said, an interruption in this, what we know is very cyclical. So if I have heard time and time again the women say, if I had had this sort of help when I was a child, I might not be in, you know, in prison today. If there was some framework, if there was a safety net, if there was some coordinated response to children who we know have experienced a great deal of trauma and are living in risk, they're not at risk, they're in risk, then things could have been different. So I think ultimately when you address these issues early and on the front end, you know, hopefully no one's going to ask for $10 million to open another prison.
Yes.
What occurs to me, and as congratulations on the work that you've done, what occurs to me though is this is taking place within Coffee Creek. Mm-hmm. To everyone?
No, that's the problem.
And that perhaps is my point, that there are folks who do not see this as the as an option. They may not understand it as an option. They see it as something that is outside of their community approach to dealing with this situation. How do we get through that? And I, knowing who to talk with is one of the biggest issues that I've run into in talking with people regarding poverty, and with parents and schools. If they don't know who to talk with, or that they don't trust the people who are there, you know, the idea of going in and talking with the teacher is, I know of enough parents who are frightened to do that. They had such a bad experience in school that they don't want to go anywhere near a classroom or a school at all. So how do we break through that? I would be curious to find. To find out how we do break through that.
You're talking about the inmates,
yes,
not knowing?
Yes.
That's not true.
Okay.
The inmates know, especially the female inmates, especially on the medium side. There's, I think, 650 beds on the minimum side. Every single one of those women, whether you're a mom or not, they know about FPP.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's just how it is. Whether it's the monthly speaker series, which is open up to the entire population to come in and learn things about anywhere from healthy eating to domestic violence to, I believe, Mercy Corps may have come in and talked before. There's different attorneys that come in and talk. There's all sorts of stuff. The women know. They know also because of the visits that happen. And they just like they know that the Girl Scouts come every other Saturday. You just know. Just like they know that the correctional officer shifts, you know. It's as easy as dropping a kite, which is the way the inmates communicate. What happens is there's not enough people to give the services.
So you're talking about capacity of
so. Right now, so the whole population, whoever can cram into the chow hall can go to those speaker series. As far as the resource center, which takes care of all this pre-entry type stuff, the phone calls, the emails, the letters, the whatnot, I think they're servicing 80 people, which is just inmates. 80 people represent however many kids, however many caretakers. Now, if you go to the, which is, I think, what we're talking about as far as the children, the Bill of Rights, and really the pre-entry stuff that really we could maximize and touch everyone. And then there's a more focused group, which involves the visits with kids and that more intensive therapeutic adult education, child education work, and that's around 12 people, which represents, again, a chunk of kids, a chunk of this. If there was more people providing those services, if there was more space that the DOC allowed, then you could service more families. With the exception of, there's not a lot of families that are willing to, meaning not the inmates, the inmates are always willing. There's not a lot of families that are willing to give the inmates a second chance. So there's a lot of work that the counselors have to do to even get their foot in the door, like, well, would you consider this? So that's a big issue. There's also the issue with travel. It's not super feasible for somebody who's from Klamath Falls or Ashland to be able to participate in this program, because you don't want to put a kiddo in the car for 5 hours one way just to see your mom for 3 hours. It just doesn't make sense. It's doing more harm than good. So there's all sorts of other pieces that exclude people from the program. But there's the inmates know, and there's people that want to help. There's just not enough room. For example, from the time FPP was shut down to now how they've been reinstated, the DOC moved the whole program out of what's called the programs building, which has several classrooms, plenty of space, bathrooms, everything. Moved them out of that into the chow hall, which has a limited capacity and is further... there's more issues because we have count time, and so the count time, that space is shared with the kitchen workers. The kitchen workers have to be there on time because they feed all the population, so there's all these other stipulations that have caused issues. So I guess you're the only DOC person here, not that you're making those decisions, but there's all sorts of security. Oh, I'm sorry. There's all sorts of perceived security threats that Captain McCorkill and other staff there have put forth, and thus encouraged the program to be moved to different areas, thus not helping as many people as they could.
So I just had a clarifying question, if I may, Representative Frederick. Is the question about the capacity of the program to serve, or who is being served, or how people receive services?
Primarily, okay. But the capacity is not just, my concern that I keep running into is not just whether you have the counselors or the people who can serve, but the encouragement, the true encouragement of people to get involved. I mean, you may know about it. You can have that sitting there in front of you, but if you don't think that it's going to be effective for you, you're not going to go any further than just reading the flyer or hearing a brief lecture. If you say, you can contact your school and be involved with your child in the school. If you have a fear of that school, you're not going to even think about doing something.
You don't do it by yourself. You have it. We had all this training on how to even write a letter to the teachers and what to say, and then somebody would help edit it. You're on a speakerphone, and you have somebody next to you going, "You're doing a good job." You know, you come up with questions and way to go. And so there's all sorts of, it's a total therapeutic process to even go through that.
But you need to have the capacity of people to be able to stand on that side of the phone.
Yeah.
And my point is, you have to have the motivation for someone to say, I will spend some time doing that. Not just the staff member, but the person, the incarcerated person, saying, if I spend the time doing that, it'll be effective. That's one of the concerns that I have. Yes.
I need to know. And there's a real challenge. There's a real challenge, whether you're talking about out of Coffee Creek, out of the other institutions. OIA and those kids coming back into the community have a tremendous challenge dealing with our educational system. I just need to put that out there.
Absolutely.
That system is not as welcoming and open-armed and willing to deal. The so-called stigmata is there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask a question before I leave, and that is what the relationship, and I'll ask it to DOC, with DHS and their presence and their work inside the institution. whether it exists or doesn't exist, and if it does exist, to what extent that they're helpful in this whole discussion that we're having with the women and their children, particularly those who have children in foster care or in other some other form of care, or the social worker who actually can actually help bridge that gap between the institution and back into the community, how helpful are they?
Right. I can't speak to, on behalf of corrections, I can't speak to how involved DHS is. I'm happy to ask around.
Shall we do this? Shall we ask around, and shall we maybe have them invited to talk about their role? And,
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea. Kendra?
I just wanted to say, I think part of the issue is that there needs to be a shift. And I think that that's where this Bill of Rights actually comes into play, is a shift knowing, from an inmate's perspective, knowing that everyone is working together instead of against one another. And in my situation specifically, my daughter was extremely affected by the fact that she was not allowed to have contact with me. She didn't understand. And now at 11 years old, she has told me, I thought you just didn't want to talk to me, Mom, because nobody fought for her right, saying she has the right to know that because of this case, there's no communication that can take place. So in the 18 months that I wasn't permitted to see her, she was crying in closets. She was completely introverted, a very clingy, a detached child, who is now, after having contact with me and consistent contact and being involved in her life prior to being released because of the program, and now after being released, she's in dance. She performs in talent shows, an excellent hula hooper, by the way. hip-hop, ballet. She is amazing on so many levels and extroverted, and she's popular and has friends, and she feels supported. And the only question is, you know, is just little details that she wants to know that she was not allowed to have. And I think if other organizations implemented this Bill of Rights, she wouldn't have those questions.
I would agree, and I think even more than just the Bill of Rights. I think that, and I've been around much longer than I care to admit, but the whole issue, and we dealt with this issue back in 71, with opening up the relationship between the parent and the child. That should not be severed simply because the individual is incarcerated. And so, and I'd like to see us revisit that again and have that conversation with DHS and those that are involved. You know, we did it when we closed, when we actually changed OWCC umpteen years ago, that they were to open up and to really work towards making certain, because you're correct, the child is just even more so traumatized than the other person going into the institution. And so, you know, to me, I think we really need to work really hard to bring that bridge, to bring those back together, and to actually have, you know, parent and child. When I did the study 18 years ago, Purdy up in Washington was doing a much better job than Oregon. I suspect if I check with Purdy right now, they probably still are doing much better than Oregon. So with that, I think I see some heads bobbing.
Yeah.
You know, I looked, I saw a documentary out of New York, and in New York in the jail, they even had the cribs in the jail.
Yep.
So you're striking a chord that I really support. I think that because we forget that what we do to the adult in our system, that it's 10 times the impact on the children.
Right. And I do want to say, and I'll call on you a second, Elizabeth, that, you know, one of the goals of the Bill of Rights, I mean, I mentioned how, you know, it's designed to create values that, you know, we all want to follow. But it also, I think one of the goals is that it be available to the children. I mean, that's an important piece of this. so that they have a sense of what their rights are. And can, you know, that was a big part of the Foster Child Bill of Rights, you know, that they were advocating for it. They insisted upon it, you know. And so I think that relationship with the children as we develop this, I think, will be very important.
I think where you have children that are old enough to understand, mm-hmm. I still think there are a lot of children who are little children,
right.
who don't have a voice yet, you know, who also, we need to build mm-hmm. that bridge between parent and child. And whether we're talking about even, I recognize that with 14 institutions that it's difficult. And not everybody is at Coffee Creek. However, I think we can do things through Skype and distance and what have you so that they're not losing connection. I don't know why, you know, we think we have to victimize and make the child pay for what has happened. And honestly, that's what's happening. If you talk to children, they feel that somehow they are responsible and to blame, or that mom or dad did not love them anymore, or they did something. And so, am I saying this right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I want to add to this. So listen to this before you leave. But after I met and heard about the Bill of Rights, I mentioned it to... I had a constituent coffee, you know, about 30 people from my district were there. And I would say that most of them had never thought about the impact of incarceration on the children. They just had never thought about it. There was one person there who's been very active in the in crime victims' rights issues. And this person was very supportive of the idea, you know, which, you know, just because this person was used to thinking about, you know, the impact, you know, of the crime and the trial and, you know, just everything, and, you know, made a very strong point that, you know, I really care about the children of the victims, but I also care equally about the children of the perpetrator. They're both caught in something regrettable and that we have to move beyond.
So, yeah. I just have a quick, I might just, I know where everybody's wanting to leave, but in terms of if children are able, are old enough to give in their informed consent to speak on these issues, you actually have to go no further than the prison system because most of the women in there are children of incarcerated parents mm-hmm. and they can give informed consent to discuss these issues and how it impacted them.
Well, I think, you know, just as... Oh, I'm sorry, Elizabeth, you had a...
Sorry.
Hi, Elizabeth, can I leave?
Hi, Sarah. Go ahead, we'll talk later. Elizabeth Kushwa, Children First for Oregon and United for Kids, and of which the YWCA is part. Just a couple of quick thoughts about the Bill of Rights, and I would love to be able to, you know, we would love to be able to bring that to all of the partners and help to work with that.
Children First was very involved in the development of the foster
youth bill of rights. So just a couple of general thoughts. The first is I think that children have the right to trauma-informed care. We've all heard about how important, what a large factor incarceration is for trauma, but no one's talking about the trauma-informed care that the children need. You can't just say, well, okay, you have a right to this without having something that is going to be changing. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, even with the Foster Youth Bill of Rights, that has not been universally disseminated to foster youth. So I would love to see, you know, as this goes out, what follow-up happens afterwards, because I love the idea, and the foster youth felt very empowered by this and proud of the fact that they could articulate for themselves, and they should have. I'd love to see every foster youth actually have that. So my two thoughts there is to have something, some perhaps more meaningful, actionable things in that Bill of Rights, as well as to make sure there is appropriate dissemination and follow-through. Thank you very much.
Two things on the trauma-informed care. We did pass a bill in the last session to look at how we can increase the the trauma-informed care support within the schools. And that's something that I think we need to look again at, because what I'm getting in my town hall meetings, and some of our constituents go back and forth, by the way, to his on the first Saturday and mine on the second Saturday. But I have a number of elementary school teachers and kindergarten teachers who tell me that they have to shut down their classrooms because of children who have been who are dealing with trauma, and it's called an empty the classroom sort of procedure. And so it's not just one kid. It is often, I mean, it's one kid often for that day. The next day it's another, and the next day it's another, because in a couple of the situations they're living, that the kids are living in homeless situations and are very much affected by it, and they act out for various reasons. So the capacity to help those children is something we still need to continue to work on.
And so we put a link to the Bill of Rights on the task force website, and it will be our starting point. So we'll work on this. And it sounds as if there's also some work for us to do with the capacity of the Family Preservation Project. So that's something we'll talk more about as well. Okay, well, great. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Good luck getting back home.
It's 5 o'clock.
Sorry to have kept you all so late, but our late start was unavoidable. Anyway, thank you very much. We have next Monday, or this coming Monday, is our deadline for submitting bill concepts. And we will be submitting a number of bills, I think, individually. And I'll be checking in with the other legislators on the group to see just where we are. And when we have our next meeting, which is...
It's not scheduled.
It hasn't been scheduled yet. It'll either be the 20th or the 27th of October. We'll do a status check on what concepts have been submitted at that point. Okay. All right. Thank you all very much. With that, we are adjourned. All right. Thank you all very much.